Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
ここいるんだ。
本当？見えないでしょ？どこにいるのかな？ね、見えない。
How you doing, Internet? It is Monday, October 9th, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio. I wanted to make sure I was doing that right. Monday, October 9th. I said it, and then I was like, was that right? I think it felt right. I think that was correct. Monday, October 9th. You're listening to Waypoint Radio. Austin does not have internet. So you're getting me as your host, Danielle Riendo. That would be me. I am joined by Patrick Klepek.
Hello, hello.
And Rob Zachney.
What's good, Internet?
I see, I can't do it. Nobody would ever believe it if I said it.
Danielle, we had a conversation about this on the Friday show.
You did?
And Austin disputes this idea that others are allowed to use the what's good, the peace. He wants to encourage the free form use of ideas on the podcast.
I see.
So just think about it. No pressure.
All right.
It has been bestowed upon the rest of us after Rob. Okay. After Rob has just been reclaiming it on his own.
panicking, really. Like, you know, things are happening around me. The pod is unsettled. And I just swim for safety, basically.
Yeah. You gotta swim for peace, swim for safety. I understand. I guess I sort of want to make my own mark on the world, you know, with my own excellent and very new phrases like, how you doing? That's good. That's good to know. If I'm feeling the vibe next time I'm hosting, I might go for a what's good.
Yeah,
I might
go. You don't have to do it. It's just one of those, like, I feel like a what's good, Internet. Like,
yeah,
you can do it. The choice is yours.
All right. Well, I'm very happy to know that. I'm pleased.
It seemed sort of like for a brief moment of time on Friday, though, that your choice was to not go to your destination. I was fearful watching Twitter. I hopped in my car. I was going to Wisconsin for a family meetup thing, and all of a sudden I check Twitter, and you were going to a very important family thing this weekend, and
yes,
it appeared you had made a terrible error in getting on a bus.
Yes.
I don't know the conclusion to this, so I need you to guide me through what happened.
All right, let me paint you the picture. So I was going to a wake in Rhode Island, and the funeral was the next day, and so I get on the bus. By the way, just to paint this fully, the 42nd Street bus terminal in Manhattan is a bananas ass place. There's like hundreds of places, you know, where you can get on a bus. It's just a really, really, really busy bus depot. However, I've taken this bus several times. You know, I my parents still live in Rhode Island. I see them pretty often, at least every other month or so. And like, you know, I've done this before, right? Maybe I'm a little bit emotional and upset because it's, you know, it's a death in the family and whatever. But, like, I get there on time. I have, you know, several minutes to go and, like, get a snack and all sorts of things. I made sure I was at the right gate, which was gate 17 for the record. And, you know, I'm there on time. And the guy scans my ticket and I get on the bus. He scanned the ticket. This is very important. I saw the green light of the scan. Like, he looked, he made eye contact with me. He scanned the ticket, of which was the proper ticket. And I get on the bus. And I'm kind of sitting there on the bus, you know, I'm kind of hanging out for a while. And then I'm like, this doesn't look like the right route. I looked on Google Maps and I was on the Jersey Turnpike. For those of you who don't know, the Jersey Turnpike is in the opposite direction of where you would go to Rhode Island. You go west to go to the Jersey Turnpike. You go east. You know, it's like east by northeast to go to Rhode Island. And I had gone straight west. And I was kind of like, shit. Did I get on the wrong bus? And I went through this whole mental checklist of like, no, it was gate 17. I'm positive I was at gate 17. I'm positive he scanned my ticket and it was green and he gave me like, you know, like eye contact kind of thing. So I start freaking out and I was like, what did I do wrong? I like recounted my steps. I'm kind of like, oh my God, did I do this? Now, I've made some mistakes in my life with travel. I have overslept, you know, past like my proper stop on trains and buses. I have missed one plane in my life. You know, there have been mistakes made. So I was kind of like, oh man, did I do this? So for a good like half an hour, I was like, okay, I definitely got on the wrong bus. And I started tweeting about it. And people were like, no, there's no reason on earth you'd be on the Jersey Turnpike to go to Rhode Island. That's the opposite direction. Something went wrong. So I'm like freaking out. And then all of a sudden I see the connector. There's like an east-west connector. It's like 287 or 278, one of those. And I was like, okay, there is a remote possibility that to avoid some of the traffic on 95, that they have taken this bananas insane
route.
But
they've never taken that route while you've ridden that bus.
They've never done that before. Manhattan. No. Yeah, it's always been, you know, they've definitely taken some different roads, that kind of thing. But it's not like there's that many choices, really, you know. So that is what ended up happening. They did actually end up taking the bananas route to kind of just get around some traffic. It was holiday weekend traffic. It was awful. I missed the wake. Like it was 2 hours late getting in. Yeah, even with this crazy inversion of the route, I was still 2 hours late and totally missed the wake.
Well, I thought it was the next day.
Well, the funeral was the next day, but the wake was that night.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, Catholic service, so there's extras.
I've been to plenty of those.
You've done that one. Yeah. So absolutely.
I had one time where just genuinely, so I've missed a flight twice. Once I overslept, and then the other time I showed up after E3 one year. I showed up to the airport to check into my flight, and they're like, the reader was like, your flight was like 5 hours ago. And I was like,
what?
Oh, huh. And so I had written it down wrong, or maybe like I like had been temp booked for one flight and then it switched. Like, I don't remember the machinations led to that moment, but I actually couldn't get upset at myself because I was like, is this one on me? Is this my fault when I genuinely believed the flight was a different time? Like, it wasn't like, oh, I didn't get in a cab early enough. Oh, like, it wasn't something where, like, I kind of dicked around and then suddenly, like, bit me in the ass. Like, I just thought, nope, my flight was at 3:30. Turns out it was at 11:15. It's like, who's this on? Whose fault is this really? And fortunately, because it was LAX, it's like, I mean, I just jumped on, you know, the next flight.
Something
and
else.
I was fine. But I think, and the other time I just overslept and it didn't end up being too traumatic. Rob, have you had like travel mishaps as well?
I was once too drunk to fly on a plane.
like they told you you couldn't get on?
No.
You made the decision.
You made the call.
No?
Oh.
So I arrived at check-in, and it was one of those things where, so I was in a hurry, which is where things had started to go wrong.
Yeah, that's bad.
I'd been drinking with friends, and I had to catch a flight. So we did one last round, but let's make it a quick one, which basically meant me pouring just an entire cocktail down my throat all at once. What turns out,
Rob,
I was probably already set. Like, you know what I mean? I was probably pleasantly buzzed, and then
this is like when you're at the bar, and then like they say last call, which is for what you should do is we should pack up our shit and go, and then you occasionally make that mistake of that means we should get one more drink. It's last call, and you just don't you. In almost in every situation, you do not need that last drink at 2 in the morning.
Yeah, and this had been, so this was the conclusion of a very weird trip anyway, where I'd been, like, behind on a bunch of work, so I checked into the Cliff Hotel in San Francisco at the end of a trip, and just, like, locked myself in a very nice hotel room and just wrote. And actually, that worked. It worked really well. It was, like, the most, traveling writer thing I've ever done, right? It's like, no, yeah. I must go to my hotel and lock myself with my drafts. And it worked really well. And then I saw some friends at the end of that trip, and yeah, should have called it, didn't. Basically tried to cram one more drink in there. Oof. And then I was like, oh shit, I gotta get to the airport. And
oh no.
Things began to go wrong quickly. One is that, like, so from the, I'm walking down the hill with my luggage, and I am getting, like, noticeably drunker as I, like, leave Union Square behind me, and I get on the BART. And the BART is, of course, running a little bit late anyway.
Sure.
And then it's I start getting nervous about missing my stop. And so, because I'm almost dozing off the train, so I, just in a panic, just get off the train somewhere.
Oh.
And I realized that I was actually two stops from SFO. called an Uber.
You're in Daly City or something?
Yeah, actually, I think that's exactly where I was.
Yeah.
And so, call an Uber. Can't find the Uber because I've suddenly become very nearsighted. Have trouble locating the Uber. Eventually do. And I'm taken to SFO. Still have time to make my flight. But as I walk up to check-in, and I'm like, do I have time to make that flight? The women at the Virgin check-in, the luggage check, sort of look at each other, look at me, and are like, no, that's probably not a real good idea.
These two nice ladies said that we're going to intervene here. We're gonna bring you back a notch, and you're going to go on that next flight.
Yeah, which, well, they didn't really do that. They're like, maybe you can catch the one in the morning.
Okay.
Oh, wow. They were like, God.
Check back here for the 8:30. And I was like, cool, well, can I just go into the terminal? And they're like, maybe not such a good idea. and I was like, yeah, that makes sense. And so I ended up hanging out by the baggage claim in SFO. For the entire night.
Oh, no.
As I began to sober up. And it was the worst. Like, first of all, that baggage claim, like, they've redone Terminal 2 pretty nicely and all that, but that baggage claim is old as hell. There's, like, 25 years worth of, like, grime in that place. I'm just hanging out on the floor, you know, changing Wi-Fi networks, basically. slowly sweating out this, like, hellacious... hangover.
Sludge.
Oh,
yeah.
Boy.
Like, look, it was gross down there, but I was probably not contributing anything positive to the situation at SFO. So in the morning, they finally let me through, and I'm now stone cold sober, and just feeling utterly awful. And then I sort of begged my way onto a flight, and then my editor emails me and is like, hey, drafts look great. I need all these changes and rewrites.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So, hungover, just drenched in my own alcohol sweat, I had to basically spend the entire flight back to Boston, like, doing pretty nitty-gritty edits on a pair of 2,000-word features.
Oh, boy.
Oh, my God.
While we're, like, yeah, while I've got, like, a middle seat and the flight is bumpy.
Rob!
Yeah, it was one of the worst travel experiences of my life, and it all stemmed from the fact that I just, like, if I just hadn't had that drink, everything would have been fine.
That one decision, that was all it took. Yeah. Oh, my Lord.
So, anyway.
God. That sounds atrocious. Next time we talk about travel mishaps, I'll tell you about the time I spent 22 hours in LAX.
Gross.
Trying to get a one-hour flight back to San Francisco.
It was bad,
but I don't know if it was
like,
as
I feel like
bad.
You've told me enough. I don't know anything about that.
22 hours, I think that beats my story just in terms of sheer quantity.
No, but you suffered. Rob, you suffered. It sounds like
not
you really...
Not as much as the kindly middle-aged woman next to me did.
Oh, that's, you know...
I think I had a bad flight. I think she had, like, a legendarily, like, hell tour of the sky.
Oh, God!
Like...
Hell tumor of the sky. I think we have our episode title. I think that's situated. That's pretty good. Well, you know, not to talk about travel mishaps any longer, because, you know, we could have a whole podcast about that. But let's talk, Patrick, I know you wrote about this last week, but let's talk about the hot topic of the day here is loot boxes and kind of what's going on with that. I know
Forza, actual topic. We're not talking,
you know,
about
we're talking about
topic.
Hell tumors. We're talking about hell tumors here. So let's talk about loot boxes and how they're used And I know it's the new Shadow of... It's not Shadow of Mordor, it's Shadow of War.
Shadow of War, yeah. Yeah.
They
really
missed an opportunity of calling it Shadow of Wardor. I'm just saying.
Or Shadow of Mordor.
Fuck you, Rob. Come on.
Accurate.
What's up, Danielle? You like
accurate.
That one?
Accurate. I loved it. I'm writing down a little note. Tell him. I mean, my dad would really appreciate that, I'm just saying.
Ugh, I'm going to go wake my kid up so I can get out of this podcast.
She woke up. Gotta go.
She's
screaming.
That pun was so bad that my kid felt it reverberate through the microphones and into her crib. And now she's awake. I think this is going to be a sort of regular topic for video games, at least for the foreseeable future. So if people aren't familiar with the concept of loot crates or loot boxes, they sort of... not originated, but were certainly popularized in a lot of free-to-play games like League of Legends or Dota. Dota especially has a huge economy based around the idea that the game is free and that you are opening these boxes that give you often aesthetic sort of things, like different skins or different skins for a weapon. You know, the idea being that you can look cooler even if the base game is sort of free for everyone. And these aesthetic things are often used as like the main underwriting of like the development budget and all the other stuff that goes into these games. But they've over time started making their way into like full priced products. And it seems like in 2017 and especially this fall is where this is coming to a head. It's not that loot crates haven't been in previous games. Overwatch has made a ton of money and been very successful in deploying loot crates. I don't think Overwatch is $60, right? Is it? But it's...
It might have been. I think... Let's see.
It's not free. I'll just say it's not free, right? So it's not free. And often people made their peace with loot crates because in a free-to-play game, it was understandable that... you had to have some sort of revenue stream that wasn't just like plastering ads on loading screens and things like that. So I think
it looks like there's a $40 edition and a $60 edition. So it's okay. One of those.
So I think, you know, people largely, even if they like had sort of ethical issues, which I think a lot of people, including myself, have ethical quandaries with the idea of loot crates and how they are explicitly gambling for all ages as opposed to the way gambling laws often work. and so this really has come to a head this fall, and two games have been under a lot of scrutiny, both Forza Motorsport 7 and Shadow of War. Shadow of War in particular, because in order to unlock the quote-unquote true ending for the game, you have to participate in a post-game event. You know, one of the criticisms people had of... what was the one before Shadow of Mordor? Was that what was the other one before?
Yes.
Was that once you beat the game, like, you enjoy... like, people wanted more things to do in the world. And so they made this post-game event that involves sort of... once you've captured these castles in Shadow of War, that you have to then defend them from armies. So it flips the script on one of the events that you're commonly doing in the main game. But in order to continue to protect those strongholds, you need, like, really high-powered orcs. And there was some criticism in a number of reviews that said in order to do that at a pace that didn't feel extremely grindy, that you had to participate in the loot box sort of structure they'd implemented in the game, and that yes, you can spend in-game currency, but eventually you start running into a wall, and then you have to spend real money in order to do it at a pace that doesn't feel really dragged out. Forza Motorsport 7, their whole in-game car model is built around the idea of, like, you literally are opening loot boxes to get cars, and that has come under scrutiny. Also, in Shadow of War, you can get weapons and gear through different loot crates. It's not just the orcs that end up staffing the different strongholds you had. So that was the context in which I wrote a story that those games were... the argument I put forth, other than outlining how the mechanics of those marketplaces work, is that in the same way that games that poorly did things like microtransactions and season passes ended up poisoning the well for games that maybe didn't do it egregiously or just found it as a way to sort of seamlessly put in like an additional revenue stream that didn't upset the balance of the game design, that Shadow of War and Forza Motorsport 7 were introducing the idea that any game that introduces the idea of loot crates in the future was going to come under such scrutiny that the fear the mere fact that it exists in the product is going to be a net negative, regardless of how they implement it, regardless of how it's perceived by players. And you're seeing today, Battlefront 2 is under a lot of scrutiny, and people are already sort of tearing apart screenshots for Assassin's Creed Origins as a game that has some of its own sort of crates. And this is before everyone knows exactly how it's going. I think actually Battlefront 2 is a different situation because it had a beta in which there were crates and people are starting to figure out design-wise how it's implemented, whereas with Origins, people are starting to presuppose how it might work because people, I think, rightly so, are going to start assuming the worst when it comes to the implementation of this mechanic and this revenue stream. So that is a long way of setting up sort of where this conversation is at. No, and I should put an aside that OpenCritic, which is sort of a rival or alternative to Metacritic as a way of aggregating reviews, is talking about including in the way they structure how they highlight games and how they're sort of looked at critically, is introducing business models as something for people who use that website to look at, which I think is at least an interesting idea. So that sets it up. But Rob, Danielle, have you? What's sort of like your guttural reaction to this so far?
I'll let Rob speak because I actually haven't. It's weird. I haven't played a ton of games that have used this, extensively. Probably the most has been Overwatch, and I don't have a 20th of the hours in Overwatch as it seems like everybody else who's ever touched that game. So I don't have the strongest personal feelings on it because I haven't really had to sort of grapple with it myself. So, Rob, I wonder if you have stronger feelings on it.
I mean, in general, I tend not to because in most cases, this stuff still feels pretty easy to opt out of or ignore. Like, it's clearly part of Forza 7, and like the game certainly does its best to remind you that, you know, this system is in there and exists. But it's also pretty easy to, at least so far, to sort of tune out and just focus on basically playing the same Forza that I've always played, right? Just focus on racing, playing series. And I don't really need to worry too much about this system. On the other hand, maybe it is revealing that a lot of the cars I have tended to use the most came out of the initial VIP packs that I unlocked. So, you know, even there, maybe the game experience has been changed a little bit by the system existing. What I don't love is that. So a lot of these systems, were sort of, field tested first and most extensively in, particularly like in China in free-to-play MMOs, right? Like, I remember, 6-7 years ago, there being a lot of stories and critiques about some of the sort of, slot machine and pay-to-win microtransaction models you were starting to see in MMOs in East Asia. And some of them were pretty exploitative and terrible. And at the time, there was a lot of, concern and hand-wringing about what this was going to spell for, where games were headed, online and in, the United States and Europe. And it does sort of seem like a lot of that stuff has been successfully imported. Most notably, like, it's happening in premium, like, full-price games. And where a game like Shadow of Mordor seems to be Shadow of War,
Mordor. Okay, just call it more. All right.
Yeah, Shadow of More. Where it seems to sort of be taking an extra step is, it seems like it's specifically tuned to be less enjoyable, more fussy, more frustrating. Unless you start springing for the loot boxes. And that's where things start to feel a little bit weird. Like, cosmetics always felt more acceptable in some ways, just because it didn't feel like... The cosmetics always felt like the skin you put on the thing you were playing, but it wasn't necessarily the thing.
Right.
And whether that's right or wrong, that's how I always sort of read it. But once, like, the experience... Once it starts to feel like, oh, they're specifically tuning to make my experience less enjoyable if I just bought the game, And it's...
Well, there's just no way to know, right? So I think that's what I was ultimately getting at with the story, is that the way it poisons the well is that the sheer existence of loot crates presuppose, like, it plants in people's mind, there's no actual way to know, because whatever they tell you, there's just as much reason to think that a publisher is lying to you. Like, I've talked to a lot of developers over the years, like, these sorts of implementations are not usually, like, my guess is, I don't know this for a fact, but my guess is the Shadow of War team, if they could wave a magic wand, would take all this shit out of the game, because it has completely distracted from everything they've wanted to talk about the game leading up to its release. Now, by most accounts, like, it's still a pretty good game, but it is overshadowed. It is, there is a conversation happening around it that is sort of, like, blurring all of that. Now, it's not that I, like, oh, no, like, Shadow of War's marketing campaign isn't as effective as they'd like it to be. But there's almost no way to take developers, publishers at face value when they say, oh, we didn't tinker with the design of the game to accommodate this new revenue stream. Because how are you, it could happen subconsciously. Like, it may actually impact things in a way that developers do not intend, but by virtue of accounting for it, it ends up impacting the game. And then there's no way to take out the cynical version in your mind, which is that actually the marketing team, the publisher side, stepped in and said, we need you to extend the grind here because our analytics have shown. Because, like, you have to remember, this is 2017. There is a deep amount of understanding of player behavior that goes to a really creepy level where they may know, like, the exact way through focus testing while these games are in development. Well, if we make the grind this way, we can, this amount of time, we can argue to players that, like, most people can reasonably get around it, but we know or can presuppose that X number of players will default to paying to get through it faster. And that's insidious. Like, that's a really gross, it may be a valid from a public perspective, but, like, it is an incredibly gross way to start to sort of think about player behavior. And I'm not saying that the teams at Shadow of War did this, but I think it's reasonable on the side of the players.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
To start thinking in those terms, because there's no reason to not think that they haven't thought about it in those terms. And once you've framed it that way, it's pretty much impossible to get away from it. These same sorts of conversations happen around DRM, which is why you have, like, folks like CD Projekt Red getting, you know, so much praise for just saying, we're just not going to put DRM in our games. Now, they didn't start there. They had DRM in their games. The Witcher 2, I believe, had DRM that was performance detrimental to the game actually performing well on people's machines, which is forced them to pivot. But and I think this runs part of what I think complicates this is that there also is a cottage industry for finding anything that you can get outraged about and then, like, whip it up, right? Like, this happens on Reddit, this happens on NeoGAF, this happens on Twitter, where, like, it takes an angle of, oh, like, there is a reason to be critical of this, and then it becomes, like, inflamed in a way that is perhaps greater than was necessary. But I don't know that that's necessarily the case for this. I think there's plenty of reason to be deeply critical of the way loot boxes are handled in games.
Yeah. I would tend to agree with that. That sounds both reasonable and also... God, I don't know. I this is one of those things I feel like I should have a stronger opinion about, because it feels like this is a sort of consumerist or consumer or anti-consumer sort of issue at its heart, in a way. So this is just something I just need to do more homework on, personally. But yeah, Rob, sounds like you had something to say there.
Well, I mean, yeah, I guess, like, it seems like anti-consumer or it seems like consumerist thing, but, like, again, how much do you or I like really give a shit? Like, we play these games. We're not busting out our credit card being like, oh, damn, like, you know, this grind is starting to get to me. I better pay money to get, you know, a loot crate so I can get a better car or better weapon. I don't think that's either of us. Like, the people who are, like, the thing that does concern me is that increasingly all games, no matter what platform you're buying them for, are going to be designed around the concept of whales. Right, the people who are like willing to just feed in cash to a game endlessly, and everyone else, the experience isn't really for them anymore. Right, it's for the people who are willing to throw away a great deal of money on these games. But at the same time, like the way these systems are cropping up in most games I encounter them, it's still kind of ignorable. Like I still don't feel like there's, you know, a design gun to my head forcing me to do this. And so to an extent, like, I've always had the suspicion that the people who are most outraged, the people who are most, like, you know, they're nickel and diming me, they're not respecting my time, I've always had the suspicion that those same people who are most outraged are also the ones who are feeding their credit card numbers into these systems. Like, I've always nursed that suspicion, and I've always sort of, like, wondered, is this just a problem for the people who can't resist the call of these slot machines?
Well, then, but that's like a much larger ethical question, because, yes, yeah. Okay, on the one hand, you know, I think the famous example of something, it's not quite analogous, but when they were removing private servers from Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 on the PC, there was a Steam group that was created for, like, we're not going to buy this game. We are protesting the release of Modern Warfare 2. And then the day of release, there was a screenshot of everyone in that group was playing Modern Warfare 2, in which, like, often, like, the outrage over it, perceived injustices in video games, and this, you know, runs the gamut, like, not just financial, just all sorts of things. People at the end of the day will still end up buying, like, it's a lot easier to, you know, sign a petition. This is true a lot of things in life. A lot easier to sign that petition or say something on Twitter than to actually put that into action and deprive yourself of that game. But I think loot boxes, especially given the amount of psychological data we have about player behavior, like, there is a, like, there are reasons, there are laws in place for slot machines and gambling in which, like, even for adults, like, there is predatory behavior to take advantage of people who are unwilling or are susceptible to the exploits of psychological-based sort of games and experiences. And there's a reason we have regulations in place to protect at least younger people who are not old enough to hopefully, you know, make responsible decisions for themselves. But I think there's, like, a real question that, like, games are possibly skating on, like, really thin ice, that it's one step away from the government sort of realizing this shit is going on. Because, like, all loot boxes are really doing is hiding a slot machine. And at the point that that becomes nakedly true, like, how do, like, what is the argument that someone doesn't step in and say, if this game can be played by people under 18, that loot crates can't exist in a system like that? Like, it is a slot machine. Like, I don't know how at some point video games don't come under, like, rightful criticism for including this as a revenue stream. So
well, if you're going to take it to that more macro level, then yeah, it sure as hell gets.
You're also right that, like, there are plenty of people that, like I said, like, it's easy to bitch, and then you may be the people that criticize something the loudest may be the ones participating in themselves. That is not unique to microtransactions or loot boxes or anything else in life. Often, if you have super strongly held beliefs, there may be a chance that you are acting contradictory in your private life and the actions you choose. Yeah. So,
this could be a case of that could be a reason for a mature or whatever rating. You know, like, oh, this game contains gambling. Should that sounds like a very legitimate reason to say, oh, yeah, this is not a child-friendly game. Like, there's legitimate gambling in here. There is basically a slot machine within this game. So not for anybody under 18.
Or maybe it gets age-gated in a way where somehow, yeah. Like, if a game is for teens, you know, like, Overwatch is a very, you know, despite being a first-person shooter, like, it's a, you know, it's not especially
pretty friendly
grotesque.
Game.
Right, yeah. In terms of the violence portrayed. So maybe there's a world where the middle ground on this is, it's age gated, but of course we all know like age gating is basically bullshit. Like,
means nothing. Yeah.
You know, like, how are they actually going to enforce that? Like, is unless you have parents that are actually going in and setting the parental controls, which while I'm glad that's
an actual
exists,
password, yeah.
You know, like I have my suspicions about how many parents are actually going in and doing stuff like that. So I don't know. I think this stuff isn't going away. I think it is reaching. Sort of a fever pitch at the moment, but I'm not going to be surprised if this is something that we're revisiting and that we don't see some backpedaling of for games that are coming out in 2018, or at least maybe a more interesting, thoughtful approach, or hiding it better, maybe actually yeah. be what happens. But, I mean, I think you're going to see that every... Like, if I was interviewing a major developer of a game in 2018, one of the questions that I'm going to feel obligated to ask is... Does your game have loot boxes, and how are you thinking of implementing that stuff? And I think every developer going forward is going to be on the hot seat and needs to, and that's useful, right? Like that, if they think they're going to get under public scrutiny, they should be under public scrutiny, and so they're going to have better answers, both internally and externally, for when people come asking why they're doing stuff like that.
Yeah, more than fair. Children should not be whales. I guess that's a.
No.
The statement I can easily come out of this with and put my foot down and say, children should not be whales.
Hard-hitting statement from Danielle Riendo. Children should not be whales.
Exactly. Rob, any further thoughts on this, or should we move on to our awesome mailbag?
Harvest them and extract their oil.
Well, it is Dishonored Day.
Too much Dishonored. Yo. Happy Dishonored Halloween, everybody.
Yay!
Wow, that's a deep cut Idle Thumbs joke that you guys are crossing over into.
It's
Waypoint Radio. We're not going to explain that. You go figure it out yourself. That's your own little that's your own ARG to figure out today.
Exactly. Go to idlethumbs.net. So we have a Shadow of Mordor question right at the top here.
Good. None of us have played that game.
Unless you asked it on Friday, I apologize. I did not listen to the podcast on Friday. I admit it, and I am ashamed.
I think we're in the clear for a question like that.
All right, great. So this is from Dan from St. Louis. Dan says, happy 100th episode. Love hearing you guys. You've been good and been good at it, so thank you for that. Thank you, Dan. That's very nice. All right, here's a question. With Shadow of War less than 2 weeks away, do any of you remember who your nemesis was from Shadow of Mordor? I didn't really play it that much. Nope.
I mean, I really liked that game, and I thought that system was really well done. But I don't remember it specifically enough to say I had like this feels like a very Austin question. I feel bad that Austin's not here. Like I feel like he immediately would have some like 7-minute story about. that he is mythologized about like his experience in Shadow of War. I don't know if that's true. It just feels like in my heart of hearts somewhere Austin has a big long story of like Harm the Reckoning chased him across the map.
Yeah, Harm the Reckoning definitely did something terrible to Austin.
There's a reason I don't come up with branding and names and host a D&D podcast. Harm the Reckoning is the kind of names I would come up with. So.
I mean, that's the kind of name that was definitely in that game, though. So
I mean, that is
I don't think you're off.
Probably true. But here, this would be good if because that game comes out this week or next week.
Yeah, very soon.
But if people have stories of their own, let's put the onus on you, the podcast listener. If you have good stories from that game about sort of an experience you had. With your own Harm the Reckoning, please write in and let us know, because I would be curious to hear some of those stories, and so maybe we'll hold that for Friday, and we can revisit it with Austin if he has a particularly good story.
Yeah, I think that's good. That works for me. All right. So the next one here comes from Ben from Indiana, and Ben writes, during some other Waypoint Radio, you talked about a game with a hidden morality meter, and it got me thinking. Are there any games with moral choices where you really get ahead by being a villain? People can cheat and scam in real life because if you could do it right, it'll make you a millionaire. Or can make you a millionaire, rather. Games seem to offer the normal person, quote, good route, and another option to be a big teen snark toolbox that is supposed to be evil. Shouldn't choosing to get ahead at any cost really let you get ahead or alternatively punish you for getting caught? Love the show. Ben from Indiana.
Hmm. I mean, I think that is like a general problem in games that they don't make. I wish they made the evil path more compelling to fight against the general nature of most players, which is to be, you know, the Han Solo type of, like, you generally
lovable
good
rogue.
But occasionally a dick. And I wished more. I mean, this, it was the what was that RPG? Was it from Obsidian? Like, what, there was the game that was about being evil from last year. Oh, what was that game?
Tyranny?
Yeah, yes. Right? Yeah. Isn't that game like sort of explicitly about like, hey, yeah, you're just the bad guy?
Yeah, up to a point. Like, as I understand it, it's more the setup is you're not so much the villain as you are like the villain's primary enforcer, right? You're like conciliary to the devil. And within that, you can decide, like, yeah, you're dealing on a spectrum of evil, but you can sort of decide what brand of evil, right? Like, right, are you going to be more the Machiavellian, like, well, we're going to have a nice orderly evil that, like, works for most people, or are you going to be some sort of, like, you know, chaos god Slaanesh type character, just like, yes, let's feast on the blood of innocents.
Yeah, I think that's probably at least in my experience when I've played games that present me with those options, I think the best way to force the player's hand is to just pitch it as like they are evil to begin with. Like, if you're starting from that angle, and they're still going to, at least the spectrum happens on from that perspective, as opposed to how I think most people play, which is like, oh, I'll do the good Han Solo path, and then on my second playthrough, I'll be the asshole just to see how the changes, you know, the choices are different, and stuff like that. So I just know it's one of those things where the game needs to be heavily tilted in a certain direction for my player behavior to change, and not enough games actually force my hand in that way. Especially as someone that tends to only play a game once, I wish more games, like, found ways to bend and break me. Like, I'm actually curious to see how the next game from Don't Nod, the Life is Strange folks, is a game called Vampire, which is, it's a, you know, a Life is Strange style game in which you play as a vampire and you will choose your victims, I guess. I haven't seen much about how the actual mechanics of the game play out, but it seems like that may be a game that tries to do something similar to Tyranny, where it's like, well, you're a vampire, so, like, you're gonna fucking kill people. But, like, how you choose to do, like, does that mean you're, like, a good vampire that's, like, helping solve mysteries by, like, sucking the blood of, like, serial killers? Like, I don't know what the angle is going to be there, but at least that seems like a game, and I wish more games would come from that perspective. Not because, like, I necessarily need to, like, get into the head of evil, but I it would be nice if more games found a way to at least provide, like, a meaningful reason to want to engage with that side of it, just because that's just almost never what I end up doing.
Yeah, I can only think of smaller games that do this in interesting ways. And it's not an explicit morality system, but, like, J.B. Gwaltney, who now is at Game Informer, I think?
Yep.
He wrote a sort of an IF game that was called The Terror Aboard the Speedwell. It was basically an Alien-esque scenario, and there was an option you could take sort of right at the beginning of the game. Somebody, you know, you're basically in, it's basically Alien, and, you know, somebody comes and they're like, oh my god, I got infected, and you just shoot them. Like, that's an option, to just shoot the person, and the story actually really supports that and goes in that direction, and it's amazing that it does that. And it's pretty rare in bigger games to really kind of go for it and really kind of support, I don't know, to support the path that you're really on, or support, like, a really radical choice right at the beginning. That's really rare, and I understand why. I know, you know, these games are expensive, and if you make content, you want people to see it, and so on and so forth. But I respect the hell out of it, any developer who kind of goes all the way with something and actually sort of commits to a story path. So, yeah, that's about the only one I can think of.
Yeah, I mean, I think that speaks to, like, the lack of, like, that sort of meaningful option in games.
It's
a really interesting question that we have very few answers to, because I think most games put in, understandably so, because this is where most player paths go down, is making the goodish path, like, really satisfying, and not enough time. But I mean, maybe that happens because they presuppose, because player data says, like, why put as much effort into that side, because most players are going to err on the side of goodish anyway, which is where that's why I land on, like, if you just restrict that, if you take that away from players, that's maybe the only way to sort of guarantee they'll head in that direction.
Yeah, very true. I, completely on this topic, but slightly random, I've always wondered if that is like a culturally dependent thing, or if all players everywhere kind of go down that path.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah,
or like, oh, this is a Western thing, or an American thing even, where like the Han Solo sort of archetype is more attractive to us than other cultures. I don't know, I'm just... That's just a complete random thought, but I've always wondered. I've always wanted to, like, see a complete analysis of, like, player behavior in morality systems, like, across the world. Anyway, I don't know at all. That was just putting that question out there. Let's do one more question. And this one comes from Matthew. And Matthew writes, "Hey, Waypoint. I was reading old video game magazines and found a piece from Woke Gamer himself." Wait, have you read this one already? Actually, no. I think we did. This was about you playing WoW. I remember this question.
Oh,
yeah.
I remember this question.
We did do this one, yeah.
Sorry, this one hadn't been erased. You know, Austin's fault.
Blame Austin.
Austin.
Fully on board with that.
What happened to be good, Austin?
Yeah. You know? All right. Let's see. There's a good one here. This one looks... This is a heavy one. Are we ready for a heavy one?
I'm sure. End on a
heavy one. This one's from Andy. Andy writes, "I'm struggling a bit this week with the concept you spoke of regarding the concept of someone's work not being separate from the person themselves. Hope you understand what I'm referring to. It's been one of those days. I've stopped quoting Bill Cosby's stand-up, for example. That was something I used to do a lot, and it's something I have to consciously think about sometimes now, but I've never questioned that decision. It's the right thing to do. But what about things like Minecraft or Oculus? Those guys pretty much suck, but Minecraft is huge and connects people and teaches children. Oculus has been pushing VR forward ever since it got started. Those things did a lot of good. Or do a lot of good, rather. Even outside games. Other good things have roots that we might rather not talk or think about. Where do we draw the line? Thanks, Andy."
Rob, was it you who said in our Discord channel this weekend or maybe this morning that... Do we have to start making it like a point to like look into like the creators of like everything we write about? Because it seems like more and more we're starting to like have it revealed later, like, secretly a shitbag.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's becoming an issue now. I think part of that is there are ways that it's increasingly separate. It's not just the person, the shitbag, but there's also a lot of examples in games where the work was produced in an exploitative environment where the creator has sort of taken advantage of... the credited creator has sort of taken advantage of collaborators. So, there's a lot of cases where that stuff should probably be born in context regardless, which is a little bit different than, like, you know, just a personal morality versus, creative work. Thing. This is those are issues where I see them being a little more connected, but at the same time, it does increasingly feel like I don't like how often it feels like if you scratch beneath the surface of like, hey, who made this? There's a decent chance of being unpleasantly surprised.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair. I mean, that's and I think I don't know if we've talked about this question on Waypoint Radio before, but it's something that comes up every couple of years, pretty often in all sorts of media, of like, you know, what do you do when something you enjoy is revealed to have, you know, folks that worked on it in which you disagree with either actions they've taken or the, like their politics. You know, and Shadow Complex is sort of the prime example of this from a number of years ago, and I think is still decently instructive to this day, where it's like, that game is a really good Metroid style game. Like, I really fucking liked Shadow Complex a lot. And like, what do you do when you find out that Orson Scott Card, you know, has said a bunch of and contributed to like about a lot of really shitty things about homosexuals? Like, how do you reconcile all of those things? And sometimes you end up not reconciling it and saying, I guess I'll donate some money to a good cause, but I still want to enjoy this game. Like, I think all of us are certainly guilty of being like a hypocrite because we like a thing a lot and we find a way to look past it, or we find a way to rationalize it. And that's not me saying that you can't enjoy Shadow Complex. Like I just said, I just did. And I think this is going to come up a lot with all sorts of different games, you know, especially in an era where people's politics are like a lot more on their sleeves, which means that we know a lot more about creators and how they feel, and that's going to make us feel awfully complicated when that comes up. I mean, I think I'd rather know than not know, and then just try to work through what it means when I err on the side of continuing to enjoy a thing, even if that creator has done things that upset me or made me feel conflicted. There's like no good answer to this. Like it's like one, it's case by case. Like how egregious is the infraction?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it just that they said something shitty on Twitter, or did they commit sexual assault? Right. Like there's a whole range of like what we're talking about that I think influences how you would ultimately fall on it. Like, is it just one person on a really large team? Like, you know, that changes the dynamic of how you might feel about that. You know, was it like forcefully condemned by the people around them once it like became clear that it was bad? So I don't know. I mean, again, like whenever this comes up, I always feel bad because I don't have, there's no, you know, magic wand to wave to make this feel good. It's always going to feel uncomfortable. So I think like my best advice onto it is always to just engage with why it's uncomfortable and to talk about it and then kind of see where you fall on it from a case by case basis.
Yeah, I think one thing that it sounded like, Rob, maybe you were getting at is there is something of a difference between, okay, the labor of making this game, there was some sort of exploitation in, like, the mm-hmm. labor itself, versus, oh, this creator is an asshole, you know, that kind of thing. That might be one way of approaching it. I don't know that that's, like, the only way of approaching it, or, you know.
Definitely not.
The amount of harm that someone does is an incredibly complicated thing to wrestle with, as you're saying, Patrick, of course. That, like, the amount of harm they do in the world is incredibly difficult to gauge, right? Versus the amount of harm they're doing by making a certain thing or putting a certain piece of work into the world, right? Like, it's... Like, I'll be the first to admit this. Like, I love Eminem. Like, I have loved a lot of his music, and I'm a fucking feminist. And, like... He sure wrote a lot of songs about killing women. Like, that's a thing. That's a real thing that I will probably forever wrestle with. So I think I like some of the most problematic things in the universe and will engage with them and always attempt to be honest with myself about what I like about something versus what I think is a real problem and how much you want to put your money towards somebody you think is doing real harm in the world. So that's one of those, it's between you and your maker kind of questions sometimes. That you just kind of have to work through. So, yeah.
Good luck.
Yep, good luck. Good luck. Enjoy. I think that's probably good for us. So I'm going to go through the usual. Patrick, where can people find you online?
Find me at Patrick Buck.
Awesome. Rob, where can people find you?
At Rob Zachney.
Oh, that's awesome. You both have really easy ones. It makes me happy. It's really, really good. I'm at Danielle R.I. I guess that one's not too tough either. If you use my whole name, it would just be like every vowel and it would get confusing. So Danielle R.I. for me. And of course, if you have questions, you can send them to gaming@vice.com with the subject question. It's not gaming advice, it's gaming@vice.com. Just in case you ever mishear that one, that's what it is. Shoutouts to Bowen for letting us use his track Miss You off of the EP Pale Machine. Shoutouts, of course, always to all our friends who helped produce this podcast, Rob Schulte, of course, everybody who helps us out on the Waypoint team. You can follow all the stuff we do at waypoint.vice.com. You can find us on Facebook at Waypoint Vice. You can find us on Twitter at Waypoint. You can find us on YouTube at Waypoint Vice, and we will actually be updating that again very soon. Thankfully, we might be having some extra help there, and that's gonna be an announcement soon, I think. So, thank you all so much, and forever, be good or be good at it.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.